With the holiday shopping season upon us, how about a good book or two for the readers on your Christmas list? I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents the Best New Books by Kansans or About Kansas. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects 15 books as Kansas Notable Winners. In the second of a two-part series, we'll hear from the 2017 Kansas Notable authors, including fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult literature, and more. It's my favorite show of the year, a chance to read some good books and meet the authors. If you missed last week's show, part one, with authors Alex Grecian, Dennis Etzel, and more, it's now archived at our website, kpr.ku.edu. But now it's on to part two of the 2017 Kansas Notable Books. Janelle Diller is the author of Never Enough Flamingos, the story of a Mennonite family in rural Kansas.
This book really is about what people do when they feel like they have no choices. And so early on, the family is faced with some very difficult moments. They fear they're going to lose their farm. And then there's another piece that pushes them over the edge. And it ultimately, they are saved by a very wealthy church member who provides a loan, pulls the family from the brink, literally of living in a ditch, starvation. And so in the short term, everybody wins because the family can stay on the farm and it stays intact. But in the end, everybody loses. The benefactor gains a foothold into the family. The son goes off and works for this man and gains lots of new ideas. And the father feels like he no longer is the provider, and it's everybody loses. And what happens throughout the book then is that it's just a slow discovery that this man is not who people think he is. And so that's where the book goes. He's very charismatic. He is very generous. He has this wonderful, warm spirit to him. And even the best people can have a dark side.
Tell me about the title, Never Enough Flamingos.
Yeah. It's a reference to the mother, to Mama, who was a flamingo in a sea of turkeys. She saw things that people didn't see. She had intuition. Now, just because you see things doesn't mean you act on them. But we all should be more flamingo-like in whatever it is that we do.
What was the spark or the impetus behind this story?
This story, I was pregnant with this story for 30 years before I ever wrote it. The seeds of this story started in 1970. My sister had an assignment. She was a freshman in college. She had an assignment to interview family members and create a family history. So I tagged along with her. She went to interview our grandfather, the only living grandparent we had at the time. And she was asking him questions about World War I and World War II and what was it like in the Dust Bowl and the Depression and all of this. And he sat there and he told us these stories. And he talked about the dust clouds rolling over the hills and picking up so much dust that at night they would go to bed with a wet kerchief over their mouths and wake up to rings of dust around it. Or there'd be an inch of dust on the windowsills. And it was whatever the dust storms didn't take away, the grasshoppers finished. And the family was poverty-stricken. They lived on the edge through those years. And the only thing that kept them from truly starving was that they had a small herd of milk cows, five or six. And my grandpa started telling the story where he walked out to the pasture one night to bring in the milk cows, and he didn't see them in the field. And then he looked up, and he saw the buzzards circling. And as he came over the knoll, there was a small herd of milk cows, dead and bloated by the creek. They'd gotten into some loco weed, and they had died. And as he told this story, 40 years after it happened, he began to sob, and he cried into his hands, and he said, "I didn't know how I was going to provide for my family. I didn't know." And to see him be so emotionally moved about that moment. 40 years after the fact, he still couldn't talk about it without sobbing. It wasn't just tears, it was sobbing. I knew that was going to be a story for me that I had to write about. So that was really the beginning. And literally for the next 30 years, this story played around in my head. And there were other components. The book is about sexual abuse, too. And those stories came from, we're women. We all know women who have experienced that. And men, too, but primarily women. And as I listened to those stories over the years, I thought, here are these farmers who had no means to provide for their family. And what did they have? They had sons and daughters. And what choices did they make so that they could keep the family farm, so they didn't have to go live in a ditch, so that they wouldn't be destitute? And I think this sort of thing happened then a lot more than people admitted. You know, we often just don't want to know. And so the story also parallels what was happening in Europe at the time. And so if you think about, people didn't want to know what was happening to the Jews either. Because if you knew, then you had to do something. And if you knew about these daughters, you had to do something.
Tell me about the protagonist in your book, Kat Peters.
One of the Kirkus reviews called her sarcastic, and I was kind of disappointed because I don't like that word. I think she's pretty honest, and she's self-deprecating. I think self-deprecating is a much better word than sarcastic, but I didn't tell Kirkus reviews that. So she starts at about age 6 or 7, and by the end of the trilogy, because this is a trilogy, there are 2 more books after this. And by the end of the trilogy, she is 20, 21, something like that. And it's a coming-of-age story for her, what she experiences, and what she experiences with her friends who have also experienced Simon Yoder, the benevolent and not-so-benevolent, generous man. She's pretty independent, and I like that. She's got a lot of spunk. Mm-hmm. And she's, so I grew up Mennonite. This is about Mennonites. And so there's a lot of Janelle in Kat in terms of her theology and her perspective about organized religion. And at the end of the day, she still embraces what she grows up with, and yet there are so many ways where she knows it's not right. A lot of people look at Mennonite in there and they think, oh, you know, I don't want to read this. Or they'll say, is this typical of Mennonites, you know, sexual abuse? And what I always say is, it's no more and no less typical than any other group. The way I look at this is I have a metaphor that the Mennonite part of the story is the print on the fabric. And that print could be Catholic. We know it can be Catholic. It could be Baptist. It could be Mormons. It could be really any social construct where there's hierarchy and power. So the print can be anything, but the warp and the weave are about power and hierarchy. And anytime you have that, you have people who are vulnerable, and they are always children, and often women. I've had some amazing discussions in book clubs that I've gone to where we start talking about women and women in the 30s and even women today, and how there is a hierarchy in so many theologies. And Mennonites, certainly in the 30s, were very much that way. Today, not necessarily. It varies by congregation to congregation. But it's, my congregation has a female pastor and I love her dearly. But even today, there's quite a women should be silent, they should be submissive. Certainly in the 30s, there was a mindset that the dumbest man is more capable than the smartest woman, and that gets people into trouble.
Janelle, do you have an excerpt you can read for me?
Yeah. I come from a long line of storytellers, which isn't my fault. The burden of this is that I can never just tell you something. I have to give you the context, that frequently begins with, "I was born in a small town in Kansas just before the Depression." You'd be surprised how often that bit of information is important. When we were children, you could have asked me and my brother Ben what we had for supper, and he who somehow escaped the family curse would have told you, "Potatoes and ham gravy." Four words. Of course, it lacks detail, substance, and nuance, even if it does actually answer your question. I, on the other hand, would have felt driven to tell you about the drought, the price of pork, the relatives who gave up and moved to California, and the surprising ways you can stretch something into not much, but enough to get full on. I'd eventually remember to circle around and tell you about the potatoes and ham gravy, but that'd be after I also told you about the piano lessons I never got but always wanted, and the fact that my brother was a terrible speller and for his entire life spelled women weemoan. Ben used to say, when you ask Cat, that's me, something, you better have your knitting along. I've speculated about why Ben doesn't talk much. Back in the 20s, we used to have bands of gypsies that will jangle along the back roads between here and nowhere worth going. I think they stole Ben from some dull Lutheran family up north in Pawnee County. And when they realized he was never going to be able to distract people with any witty conversation, they dropped him off on our doorstep, thinking we Mennonites would never even notice he was boring. I showed up after he did, so although my mother always denied my version of things, I'm not convinced. Of course, I'm only telling you this, so you'll forgive me if I tell you more than Ben would offer about that awful day in the early 30s when the Sweet Home Bank closed, which was really the start of things. In fact, if you want Ben's version of those years, here it is. The Depression nearly destroyed us. The war was worse. My version? Well, I think you need to know a little more.
That's Janelle Diller reading from Never Enough Flamingos. It's the first of today's Kansas Notable Book Winners, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas, selected by the State Library of Kansas. Greg Olson's Kansas Notable book is Iowa Life, Reservation and Reform, 1837 to 1860. It's the story of the Iowa tribe, their forced resettlement from Missouri into northeast Kansas, and the role of the Great Nemaha Subagency.
That was the name of the, well, it's basically a government designation. It became known as, you know, the Iowa Reservation, and then next to it was the Sac and Fox Reservation, but the agency was named after a river that goes just north of the reservation. But the agency was the government entity then that had daily control over the Iowas and the Sac and Fox.
How successful was the sub-agency at their stated mission, which was preparing the Iowas to enter mainstream American society?
Well, initially not very successful. And part of that was their own fault, because government agents got their jobs because they had political patrons. And so, in fact, I'm just now doing some work where one of the agents that they had after this book takes place was very tied to Jim Lane, the senator here. And so because of that, it was just rife with graft and all kinds of political shenanigans. So it really, an interesting result of that was, I think, that the Presbyterians, who had a mission on the reservation, ended up having a lot more control because you're having a new government agent come in sometimes every 18 months, and there was a period of 18 months where there was no agent at the agency just because of politics, and very much tied into what was going on in Washington at the time. Whoever might be in the White House had an effect on who was manning the agency. So as a result, the Presbyterian missionaries had a lot more control because they were there for the entire time.
Let's jump ahead to 1854. The Kansas-Nebraska Act is passed by Congress. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the effect that has on the Iowas, who are then living in Kansas.
Right, in what was then Kansas or Kansas Territory. And yeah, immediately, Kansas has an interesting land history, and it took me a long time, not being from Kansas, to sort that out, and I'm still not sure I have it right. But But, you know, with preemption laws and squatters associations and things like that, there was a lot of pressure on the U.S. government. You know, a lot of whites wanted that land and they wanted the native people gone completely. And in fact, a lot of the nations that were up there were forced out completely, but four of them were able to hang on. But because hunger, you know, white settler hunger was so strong for that land, all the tribes that lived up there, the Iowas, the Sac and Foxes, the Kickapoos, and the Potawatomis all gave up major parts of the small reservations they had to begin with. So today, they're just little dots on the map, really, compared to what they had originally.
One of the stories that you tell in your book, Iowa Life, is the sad story of poor Lucy.
Yeah, that's a project. I found that story when I was working on another project about a folklorist from St. Joseph. And then it was confirmed to me by a tribal elder who said that when he grew up, he heard stories of white settlers taking native children to work as basically domestic servants. One of the odd things, that kind of a coincidence of history, is that the Oregon Trail ended up going right through the middle of both reservations. And so it created a real conflict of cultures that happened quickly, more quickly than it would have otherwise, because suddenly the Iowas have, I mean, thousands of wagons going right through the middle of their settlement, and these people are leaving trash, they're cutting wood, you know, their cattle are eating up all of the grass and forage, and then to top it off, children were being kidnapped. We have no way of knowing how often this happened, but the fact that Mary Alicia Owen in the 1920s wrote a story about poor Lucy being taken to California with a family, basically to, you know, work for the family, taking care of the kids, and then the fact that this elder in the 2000s told, you know, said that as a child, he'd heard similar stories. And what happened to poor Lucy is she went with a family out to California, and the family was going to strike it rich in the gold fields. And of course, as so often happened, they didn't strike it rich. And so the family came back defeated. And when they got to the reservation, they dropped poor Lucy off where they found her. But of course, several years had intervened in between. Lucy was older and her family was nowhere to be found. And she didn't know whether they had died or maybe they'd moved. You know, a lot had happened in those years. So it is a sad story. And apparently, even though it's folklore, there is some basis of truth, we think, to it.
Talk to me about White Cloud and the careful line he walked between Native Americans and the white people.
Yeah, White Cloud, Francis White Cloud. And just that's an interesting thing right there, his name, because his name carries both his, you know, the fact that his father would have been known as simply White Cloud. Mahuthka is the Iowa word for that. And he was a revered leader. And then Francis White Cloud, already you have the fact that he carries a Christian name and an Iowa name. And that's a great symbol for the fact, the way he had to live his life. He wanted to be like his father. His father was an assimilationist and thought that really they had no choice but to go along with what the whites wanted, because the whites had the power, in his view, to kill them. But Frank had really bad, you know, he resented, I guess is the word. He resented the way his people had been treated. And as much as he wanted to do what his father had told him to do and follow along with what the whites wanted, his heart just wouldn't let him do it. And then he, to make matters worse, he found his role in the tribe diminished because the government agents became more powerful and took over a lot of the roles that the chiefs would have had originally. In the end, Frank really struggled to try and maintain his leadership, to the point where he launched an ill-advised ambush, basically, on some Potawatomis up in Nebraska. And among the few that were killed were a Potawatomi girl and a Potawatomi child and a woman. And of course, that was the end of Frank's leadership role. And then, of course, there's the whole story of the Iowas going to Europe with George Catlin's show, basically, kind of an early version of a Wild West show. And Frank White Cloud thought that it would be, Catlin had invited them. What happened is George Catlin took about 500 portraits that he had painted of Native Americans with him to Europe, and P.T. Barnum backed him in a show that they were sure would make a lot of money. And in the beginning, Catlin would show these paintings in a hall that he would rent, and then he and some of his family and friends would dress up in Native clothing, and they would explain, they would do a little show and tell about Native life. And of course, in Europe, people just loved that.
Just to be clear, we're talking about two white people dressing up.
Right. Catlin and his son, I think, that were. So, yeah, because they had collected a lot of clothing over the years. And at a certain point, then it occurred to someone in the show that, hey, this would be a lot neater if we could get some real Native people to show instead of Catlin and his redheaded son.
That seems wearing pretty obvious.
These. Yeah. So... and because Catlin had traveled widely in the West, he had a lot of connections. He'd met Iowais in the 1830s and knew Francis White Cloud's father. So first some Ojibwees came over, and they were there for a year or so, and that business relationship soured for whatever reason. So Catlin invited some Iowais to come over, and because he knew Frank White Cloud, Frank got to be was the head of the trip, and he got to choose 14 people to go with him, 14 Iowais. And what's interesting, White Cloud thought that if he went, he could bring some publicity to the plight of the Iowais. You know, they were poor, they needed money, they needed food. They were really in a bad way. And so he thought that this would be a good trip, a good way to bring attention to the problems they had. What to me is really fascinating about it is once they got to Europe, they were actually encouraged to do a lot of the things for show that they were discouraged from doing in the United States. So they could wear their traditional clothing, they could sing their traditional songs, they could do their dances for the benefit of Europeans, and back home they were discouraged from doing any of that. And of course, the sad part of the story is that they didn't make any money. They came back poor, and in fact, a couple of missionaries, the only thing they gained on that trip was a trunk full of Bibles, and a couple of missionaries came back to join with the Presbyterians. So it didn't work out as well as Frank had hoped it would, and he never really did gain the leadership that he really, by tradition, deserved.
Greg, how did you become interested in this story?
That's kind of hard to say. I'm from Iowa. I grew up in Northwest Iowa, and going through public school, I never quite latched onto the idea that there was an Iowa people. There were Iowas around somewhere. And we were always told that it was what Iowa meant, beautiful land or something like
that.
That's
what I always heard.
Yeah, yeah. And it was really only, I was in Oskaloosa, Iowa, doing another research trip on a sculptor, and there's a beautiful statue of White Cloud Mahaska in the courthouse square there. And it was done by an Iowa sculptor named Sherry Edmondson Fry. And I read the plaque, and it said Mahaska, friend of the white man, and I'd never heard of Mahaska. And furthermore, I was really kind of vague on the fact that there were even an Iowa people. So I got back and started researching, wanted to find out who this guy was. And there, I figured somewhere there'd just be a book about him, but there wasn't. And so I wrote an article and just got interested in these people. And I think one of the things that really fascinates me about them is that I'm not Iowa and I'm not Native, but they're sort of geographical ancestors to me, because it turns out that they had lived in a lot of the same places I've lived in. They'd lived in Northwest Iowa. I live in Missouri now, and they'd lived at a certain point not too far from where I live now. So that bond has kind of kept me going, and I've just been sort of following them through history and writing what I find.
In doing the research for this book, what's the most surprising thing you learned about the tribe or their treatment?
Well, I think that initially when I started this, I had to kind of face a lot of the misinformation and the biases I had. And I always was under the impression that American Indian people were defeated or decimated, or however you want to say that, by military force. You know, you always see these movies, these Westerns about the Indian Wars, which are, you know, the most popular part of the conflict, you know, but really that was just, that happened after the Civil War. Mostly the thing that was surprising to me and that I'm still sort of trying to sort out in my work is that the warfare that settlers inflicted on Native people was cultural. It was changing the economy that Natives had to deal with. It was changing the religion that they wanted the Natives to experience, changing the education, changing the way they didn't want Native people to farm communally anymore. They wanted them each to have their own 60 acres and live on their own farm and change farming methods. So to me, the most surprising thing is that the warfare, the Indian Wars, were really more cultural than they were military.
Greg Olson is the author of Iowa Life, Reservation and Reform, 1837 to 1860. If you're just joining us, it's part two of this year's Kansas Notable Book Award winners, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas, selected by the State Library of Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Support for KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio comes from the Lecompton Historical Society's Christmas in Lecompton. Over 130 Christmas trees with vintage and antique ornaments at the Territorial Capital Museum, now until the new year. Details at lecomptonkansas.com. And from First Presbyterian Church in Lawrence, on Sundays offering a reflective worship service at 8:30 a.m., Sunday school at 9:40 a.m., and a traditional celebration at 11 a.m. More information at 843-4171. What makes a small town survive and thrive? Julianne Couch is the author of The Small Town Midwest, Resilience and Hope in the 21st Century. I met up with Julianne Couch at the 2017 Kansas Book Festival in Topeka.
In writing this book, you picked out 9 different small towns to visit and research and really try to capture the flavor of those. Mm-hmm. How did you pick those 9 communities?
Well, 2 of them were easy because I picked the place that I lived currently and I picked the place that I went there from. So I considered that sort of Rocky Mountain and Mississippi River parentheses around my life. And so Centennial, Wyoming is actually a little bit outside of where I lived, but it represents the flavor of, you know, where I was in Laramie. So that was easy to write about, or it was a starting point anyway. And then Bellevue, Iowa, where I currently live, I was just very inspired to write about, you know, what it was like to be a newcomer there in a community where literally I knew, other than my husband, I knew nobody and the realtor when we moved there. And so what was that experience like? And because if it was like that for me, what would it be like for others as well?
You picked 2 Kansas towns, mm-hmm. Sedan and
Norton.
Tell me about each of those.
Sure. Well, Norton is out on the high plains of northwest Kansas, and I picked it because it really has a lot of influences from the west. So it's very near Colorado. It's on the Nebraska border as well. So people ranch out there more often than they do, you know, row crop agriculture. And it's so consequently, they sort of see themselves as western in a way that people in eastern Kansas really don't. So I wanted to see what that community was like from that sort of self-image point of view, but also the influence of the state prison that's there and all the diversity that brings in terms of family members who make trips out there all the time to visit their loved one who's incarcerated and what that influx does and how those two big groups of people interact and what they find as common ground and how they define community once they are all in that one pot together.
Well, speaking of the prison there, talk to me about The Haven.
Well, The Haven, I came across that. I just stumbled upon this woman, you know, in the course of reporting, you just find people. And she and her husband do a mission to the prison, teaching Bible studies and so forth. She became aware that when families would come out,
they had nowhere really that they could afford to stay, and that didn't help the family unit. It did not help the man who's incarcerated. It didn't help the community. So they found a home that they could purchase for almost nothing. Volunteers worked to renovate it and fill it with these little bedrooms, and now people can come out. They have to make a reservation, but it's free, and they have a room, and they might share it with their, you know, the several kids, and, you know, it's nothing fancy. But it provides a place, a safe place, for the families of inmates to come. And it's just a very loving thing for them to do, for really no reward other than doing the right thing for the community. It's just a nice story.
Let's go from Norton down to Southeast Kansas. Tell me about Sedan.
I love Sedan. It's just a wonderful, beautiful place. Geographically, landscape-wise, it's just gorgeous. They call it the Little Ozarks. So it's very beautiful. It's got problems in that the thing that made it put it on the map, which was oil and gas, it doesn't last forever, and they have found that out. They do have an individual who put quite a bit of personal investment into the town and renovated a bunch of buildings and said, okay, let's see what we can do. You want to start a business, you can be in this place and try to make things happen.
And we should mention that person was Bill Curtis.
That person is Bill Curtis.
Oddly enough, got his radio start at KANU, the flagship station of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence.
We definitely need to mention that one. He's from Independence, Kansas. So that's what gave him, I think, that impulse to want to do something when he saw Sedan just, you know, kind of crumbling. So he put a lot of personal investment. He also started a ranch, a grass-fed bison ranch, and things are thriving. But, you know, you just have to change your definitions of what thriving means, and I think people are learning that.
One of the quotes you have from someone in Sedan is, you can live here if you want, but you'd better know how to do something.
The first thing he said before he said that was, somebody better have a job. Please, somebody have a job. And so what he was referring to is, you know, folks look at, you know, where they're going to live. They look at a community like Sedan where the housing prices are very depressed and think, awesome, you know, I can afford to live there. I can rent a house, rent a trailer, this and that. And that's fine. Come down here and be part of our community. But somebody needs to have a job. One of you, if you're a family, somebody, you just can't come here and sit. And that's the same. That ties into what you just read of, you know, you better know how to do something. You either better be able to fix things or make things or sell insurance or, you know, grow your own food. I mean, you got to know how to do something. And I think the fact that he mentioned that is an indicator that not everybody does know how to do something.
What did studying these nine communities teach you about what it takes for a small town to thrive moving forward?
Everyone is doing the same sort of thing in a lot of ways. You know, everyone is working on economic development. Everyone is trying to, you know, say, come home to wherever programs. You know, honestly, it was a program that the state of Kansas had in place that was one of the earliest inspirations for me, the rural opportunity zones. And I did a story about that for a publication I write for, and I really wanted to know, I mean, does this work? And I had someone in Kansas tell me, well, you know, it's a great idea, but I wanted to meet those people. But it was really hard to meet those people because, as someone told me, top-down programs don't really resonate as much. I mean, if you're already thinking of doing something, then you take advantage of it, but it is not the impulse behind things. So, but everyone is trying something, and it's really just, you know, the chemistry of the right mix of people, but it's also, there's got to be an infrastructure. My community had a progressive city government that viewed internet as not just as a utility, but as a necessity. And so we have fiber optic. So consequently, I could go there and do my work as a writer and as a teacher and have it be no different. But my town was set up so that those things were possible. In Sedan, Kansas, you know, the walls between their buildings are such thick stone that they can't have stuff. And the county commissioner weren't real excited about trying to move forward with that because that wasn't where they saw, you know, their future. So it's just a mix of getting lucky but having the kind of far-sighted, you know, governmental help, people understanding what, you know, rural transportation costs are inside of schools. But people locally deciding that they can run for committees and serve. You've got to be willing to do that, but you've got to have your life organized well enough that is a possibility for you. I'm coming down to just saying luck, you know, being in the right place and being able to move forward, you know, recognize when things are going well and be able to move forward in advancing that.
Julianne, can I get you to read an excerpt from your book?
Sure. In spite of amenities or location or planning, sometimes no amount of good intentions can protect a town from people's need to live someplace else. Taken to the extreme, sometimes a town literally dissolves itself and turns its functions over to the county where it resides. So-called disincorporation might happen when the town no longer has the tax revenue for services, for police and fire protection, or for streetlights and snow removal, or when no one is willing to run for council or to be the mayor. Just because a town dissolves its government doesn't mean it cannot carry on, though in an ad hoc way. Yet people who've been through disincorporation report it brings a profound sense of loss, with residents feeling they were poor stewards for the hopes of long-gone town founders who still keep watch from the quiet hilltop cemetery. Like other forms of life, communities have a cycle and transition naturally from hopeful beginning to thriving to struggling to ending their days as vessels for nostalgia and reflection, but also for rebirth. Every day, through acts of stubborn resilience, this region seems poised to reinvent itself, to grow new hope, to teach new lessons. Those lessons might be as simple as finding resilience through thinking locally but acting as a collective, being mindful that even long traditions are not infinite. Taking steps like investment in education, housing, entrepreneurship, infrastructure, and civil public discourse are important everywhere in communities of all sizes, possibly no more than in the rural areas of this region, which by many measures is in deep trouble. But the world has always been full of rooters and rangers, people who plant themselves in one spot permanently, and people who make a sail out of their mobility and let the wind be their guide. It will be a fine thing when this region finds a way to sustain those rooters and tempt some of those rangers to settle here, at least for a time.
That's Julianne Couch reading from her book, Small Town Midwest. Julianne, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This has been so fun.
Next up, a book for all you Jayhawk basketball fans. Fog, the Most Influential Man in Basketball, is by award-winning sports writer Scott Morrow Johnson. Scott joins us by telephone from his home in Seattle. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kay.
You say that James Naismith invented the game of basketball, but it was Fog Allen who brought it to the masses. Talk about the complicated relationship between the father of basketball and the father of basketball coaching.
Yeah, the word that I think both of those men would probably argue about that you used is game. James Naismith saw it as just kind of a pastime. He called it a game, but it was more of just a pastime that people were going to do in gyms, you know, around in physical education class, and kind of a way of staying in shape and maybe bonding and learning life lessons and all that. But Fog Allen came along, and right around the turn of the century, when he was a young man, he started to realize that there could be bigger things out of it. And so he saw this little seed and decided that he wanted to plant it and grow it and turn it into this multi-million dollar business that it's become. So if it was up to James Naismith, then basketball would still be being played in little auditoriums like Springfield, Massachusetts, and we wouldn't know who LeBron James or Michael Jordan or any of those people are. But because of Fog Allen, it kind of grew into what it's become today.
Talk about how that affected their professional and personal relationship.
Well, Fog Allen played for James Naismith for a year at Kansas. And then kind of the end of that year, there was a school down south of you, Baker University down in Baldwin City, that called I think they wrote a letter to James Naismith saying, hey, we want somebody to come coach our basketball team. Do you know anybody who can coach? James Naismith was technically the coach at KU at the time, but he didn't really coach basketball. He pretty much just refereed the games, and he didn't really think that there was a need for a coach for a game like basketball. So he kind of laughingly, you know, tossed the letter aside and told Fog Allen about it, and Fog Allen said, no, I think I can coach the game. And so he went down to Baldwin City and started coaching there, eventually came back to Kansas. And so that he was always kind of Naismith's protege. Right around 1920, when Fog Allen came back as athletic director after leaving the school for about 15 years and trying to osteopathy, and then he coached in Northwest Missouri for a while, he finally came back as AD. And at that time, James Naismith actually voted against him. He didn't want him to be the athletic director because he thought he was too motivated by money. And long story short, their first you know, 10 years together, they pretty much butted heads about, you know, whether basketball and sports in general should be this money-making endeavor or whether it should just be something that's just for the students to kind of do on the side. And then finally, they kind of came back together in the 30s when, after Fog Allen got the sport into the Olympics for the first time, he put together a national campaign that raised enough money for Naismith to go and actually be there in attendance. And it was 3 years before Naismith died. So that was kind of the, that kind of brought them back together. But there was about 15, 20 years there where they were kind of butting heads while they were at KU together.
You just alluded to Fog Allen's, his time as an osteopath. He really pioneered the use of sports medicine well before that was a thing.
Yeah, the one thing that was kind of unclear in my research was why he went to osteopath school. You know, the prevailing thought is probably in those days, coaching basketball and coaching sports in general didn't make a lot of money. So maybe when he went to osteopathy school in 1909 at the age of about 23 years old, he might have just been, you know, moving on to another career. Another theory is that maybe he was doing it because he realized that the two things could come together. If nothing else, Fog Allen was a visionary, and so he could see kind of these things that, that nobody else could see, like basketball becoming a big-time sport and a big-time, you know, a big-time thing in American culture. Maybe he saw the same thing for kind of physical training. Maybe he went back there because he realized that, you know, there's injuries that can be dealt with, and if I can coach players and treat their injuries, I can be that much farther ahead. He had a football back injury, like one of his first football practices at KU. He never played football again after that. And that kind of got him interested in alternative medicine because some osteopathy techniques helped him out. And so that's kind of why he ended up going down that path. But it's not clear if he did it because he wanted to get back into basketball or because he was trying to change careers. But regardless, he ended up coming back to athletics shortly thereafter.
You mentioned that at the time, and it's hard to believe now, but basketball coaches were not very well paid. What were some of the other ways that Fog Allen supplemented his income?
Yeah, in the early years, he actually, you know, when he was a real young coach, he coached at three different colleges. I think he may have been a volunteer at Haskell Institute there in Lawrence while he was coaching at KU and at Baker. And then he also worked at a grocery store, at his family grocery store, and he probably made more money doing that than he did actually coaching basketball. But then as he got older in the 20s, when he became kind of, you know, a national treasure, when everybody knew his name and he was kind of the, you know, the face, he'd become the face of basketball. He still wasn't making a lot of money, and the Depression hit, and so he had to kind of go out and find some other ways. And so he started marketing a Fog Allen shoe. He marketed a medicine, like a medicine book about, you know, how to do physical training. He started a game called Go High, which was kind of like basketball, but he was hoping it was a game that people could play in their backyards where there was kind of a movable basket. So he tried all sorts of things to try and make money, and he actually he did enough that during the Depression he was able to kind of stay afloat while people like James Naismith were really struggling financially.
In 1924, he even tried his hand at writing. He wrote a book called My Basketball Bible.
He ended up writing three different books over the course of the next 20 years or so. And yeah, he wrote My Basketball Bible kind of as an introduction to people of how to coach basketball, how to put on a basketball event. It really kind of, you know, it pretty much was everything he thought about basketball. He put down on paper how players should eat, how to treat injuries, how to run a practice, how to run a game, all that kind of stuff.
Not only did he tell them what to eat, but how to eat it. One of the things I thought was really funny about his basketball Bible was that he even gave instruction on how to properly peel an orange.
Yes. Yes. You know, for all of his wonderful characteristics, Fog Allen also had some pretty interesting personality traits. And I think he became so, you know, things were happening for him and he became such a big part of the sport that he kind of, he became a spokesman in so many ways that he thought he was in some ways bigger than he was. And so he kind of, you know, he would teach people how to do the most rudimentary things. And so, yeah, like eating an orange, he would, you know, like I said, he would help them with diet. He had these big yeast tablets that he created that had like yeast and something else in them that he basically would kill bacteria and basically would fend off all sickness. And he basically carried those around with him, gave them to his grandkids and gave them to his children and all that stuff. And he kind of, between all he knew about medicine and all he knew about basketball, I think he got to this point where he felt like the smartest man in the room, and he kind of felt like a know-it-all. And so he would be he was the kind of guy who would, yeah, tell you how to peel an orange and how to hold your fork and stuff like that.
And he was also justifiably proud of his physique.
Yes, there were some, there's a legend that apparently when he played golf at the Lawrence Country Club, he would always take his shirt off, even in his 50s and 60s, just so he could show off his physique. And when he was, I think about in his 50s, when he was coaching, near the end of his coaching career, he had come up with this foot arch roller. It was basically a roller that could loosen the muscles on the arch of your foot. And there are stories about how he, when he was showing people how to use it, he would, get in front of a room, and sometimes he would take off his shirt just to show off his physique and start rolling it. And so there were a few stories of people walking by a classroom and seeing this shirtless old man, you know, on his back with his feet up in the air, rubbing a thing on his foot. And they were kind of like, what in the world is that guy doing in there? But he was definitely a quirky man, and very proud of his body, very proud of his mind. And so you can kind of see, if you throw in, you know, the guy who thinks he's the smartest man in the room, the guy who's really proud of his physique, you can kind of see why he rubbed people the wrong way and why maybe people in the administration at KU, he started to ruffle their feathers kind of later in his career.
Scott, in your afterword, you said that writing this book was both a joy and a frustration. How so?
It was, it was a huge joy for a lot of reasons. The biggest joy was that, you know, my grandfather played for Fog Allen, and so throughout this process, I kind of felt him on my shoulder watching me do this, and I knew this was something that he would have been really passionate about, so that was part of it. And I also, you know, I just love writing, so I love telling stories, and there were so many stories in there. The frustrating part was there were so many parts of Fog's life that had never been documented, and to truly have a little bit of kind of rhythm to a book, you've kind of got to hit all the marks of his life. He wrote, like I said, he wrote three books, so there's certain stories that he told a lot. But there were also some really important things that happened in his life, like his mother dying and his oldest son dying when he was a teenager, that he didn't really ever talk about. So the hard part was kind of trying to figure out how to flush those in and bring those in. And I didn't want to make it a book about, here's all the stories that Fog Allen loved to tell. I wanted to make it a story about all of the stories that make Fog Allen who he was. And so that was really hard to try and, find some of those nuggets that he didn't really talk about and find a way to kind of tell those stories without a whole lot of information. So in a lot of ways, it was kind of frustrating. But in the end, I think that's the part I was most proud of, was that I was able to kind of research that stuff and make it flow and really tell his entire life story from birth to death.
Scott Morrow Johnson is the author of Fog, The Most Influential Man in Basketball. Thank you so much for joining us today, Scott.
Thanks, Kay. You take care.
From the basketball court to the baseball diamond, our last book on today's program of Kansas Notable Books tells the story of Topeka native Mike Torres, who pitched for 7 different teams over the course of his 18-year professional baseball career, including the St. Louis Cardinals, the New York Yankees, and the Boston Red Sox. His story is the subject of Mike Torres, A Baseball Biography by Dr. Jorge Eber. Dr. Eber joins us by telephone from Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas.
Mike is a great ball player. He won 185 major league games, which is not a particularly easy feat to accomplish. And he had a very long and, I would say, a fairly distinguished career in the majors. Unfortunately, because of one pitch on October the 2nd of 1978, he was labeled as a scapegoat. And in part, I argue that he's not really a scapegoat, but the research for the book goes well beyond that. What I focus on in my own research is the role of sport in the lives of Latinos throughout the United States from a historical perspective. So, you know, I remember seeing Mike Torres give up this home run when I was in my teens. Never did I envision the possibility that I would actually be able to get to sit down with him and talk about that particular event, but also to talk about his life in the Oakland barrio of Topeka and the significance of sport to the Mexican-American community in that city.
One of the things that surprised me when I was reading your book was the assertion by many people in the early 1900s that Latinos were not good at sports.
That argument really comes from, and frankly, let me just back up for a second. It's very similar to the argument that was made about African Americans, primarily that they were not intellectually capable of being successful in certain athletic endeavors. With Latinos, and particularly with Mexican Americans, the notion was that because of their native background and the Spanish background, that created a very unhealthy mix, and that they were, if I remember correctly, I think one of the quotes that I used in the book was that, quote, they were proud to a fault, that they were not intellectually capable, that they were poor losers. So yes, there is this sense among many, not all, in the majority population, that Latinos are not going to necessarily be interested in participating in athletics because it really doesn't hold an attraction for them. They're not willing to put forth the effort to be good at, to be successful at complicated sports such as baseball, basketball, or football. And of course, the research that I have done, the research that some of my colleagues in the field have done, goes against that idea completely. One of the things that you find very early on here in Texas, for example, is that as football, for example, comes into the state in the latter part of the 19th century, by the time that you get to 1905, 1910, there are high school teams and other teams playing football or participating in football in the border regions, Laredo, El Paso, Brownsville, that part of the state. And the same thing happens with baseball. You have Mexicans and Mexican Americans crossing the border, going back and forth and playing baseball, many of them at a pretty good, pretty substantial level, very early in the 20th century. And eventually, as Mexican Americans begin to move into places like Topeka in 19-teens and 1920s, they take those sports with them. Now, I would argue, and I think, again, the historical record bears this out, the reason that you're not going to have a whole lot of Mexicans or Mexican Americans playing high school sports in Topeka or in other locations is simply because many of the families needed as many, if not all, of their offspring to work in order for the family to make ends meet. Therefore, by the time that you're 13, 14 years old, if you're in fourth or fifth grade, in some cases, very obvious to many people in the family, well, look, you're not going to be able to get very far. You're not going to graduate from high school. So you might as well just quit and help the family make ends meet.
In what way did Mike Torres serve as a role model and a hero to Topeka's sizable Mexican-American population?
Well, you know, that is a very interesting question. And here is, I would say that he was very much of a role model for the Mexican-American population in Topeka and in other parts of the Midwest. Now, I would also argue that towards the end of the book, I compare and contrast Mike Torres with Fernando Valenzuela, who is the individual who really breaks through as far as Mexican-American athletes. Of course, Mike never played in a city that had a very, very large Mexican-American population. So he played in St. Louis, he played in Montreal. I guess really the only community that he played where there was a fairly substantial Mexican-American community was Oakland, but he was only with the A's for a very brief amount of time. Then he got traded to the Yankees. So he was not in a position like Fernando Valenzuela a little bit later in 1980-1981, where he became the center of the Mexican-American baseball universe. So he was definitely a role model. He took that, I think, that role very seriously. He was willing to go to speak to community groups. He was willing to visit with people in the Oakland barrio. You know, he was very active in that regard, but he never really had the opportunity to do that at the to the level that a Fernando Valenzuela was able to do a few years later. I think that the Chicano movement in the late 1960s and into the early 1970s is a very important context for Mike's career. You have a lot of political, social activism taking place in Topeka and, of course, in other places during the time that he is moving through the farm system with the St. Louis Cardinals and eventually getting to the major leagues. A lot of these individuals who are involved in various aspects of the Chicano movement are looking for role models. And Mike becomes, I think, a very handy individual in that regard. Now, Mike is certainly not political. You know, he's not participating in rallies or anything like that, but he's always willing to go in for the, for the festivals, for the, events that are taking place at Our Lady of Guadalupe, other things along those lines. He is very much a person that these community leaders, these civic leaders, these Chicano movement leaders can point to as, here is an example of a person who has been able to take his talents and has been able to achieve certain things. Now, your talents may not be in athletics, but it may be in an academic setting. If Mike Torres can make it, if other individuals from our communities can make it, here's a role model that you can look to as someone to try to model your life and your career on. I hope that what people get from the book, and I hope what the Torres family gets out of the book, is an opportunity to relive these wonderful stories. Additionally, it gives, I think, people in Topeka an opportunity to see a part of their community, a part of their state, that maybe a lot of folks are not familiar with. The Mexican-American community in the Oakland barrio is of very long standing, and they have contributed a great deal to the development of the city, to the history of the city, to the history of the state. And I hope that in just some small way, this is a mechanism that gets people to read about not only Mike's story, but the story of that community as well.
Dr. Jorge Eber teaches history at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas, specializing in the role of Latinos in sports. He's the author of Mike Torres, A Baseball Biography. You can find a longer version of each of today's author interviews at our website, kpr.ku.edu. There you can also find part one of the 2017 Kansas Notable Books. That's at kpr.ku.edu. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.